Chapter 11, Anatomy Class. To Bond's unspeakable relief, they put up that night at the smartest hotel in Kyoto, the Miyako. The comfortable bed, air conditioning, and Western-style lavatory on which one could actually sit were out of this world. Better still, Tiger said that unfortunately he had to dine with the chief of police of the prefecture, and Bond ordered a pint of Jack Daniels and a double portion of Eggs Benedict to be brought up to his room. Then, from a belated sense of duty, he watched The Seven Detectives, a famous Japanese television series, failed to spot the villain, and went to bed and slept for 12 hours. The next morning, hungover and conscience-stricken, he obediently fell in with Tiger's plans that they should visit the oldest whorehouse in Japan before a quick drive to Osaka for the day's journey across the inland sea to the southern island of Kyushu. "A bit early for visiting a whorehouse," had been his only comment. Tiger laughed. "It is a matter of great regret to me that your baser instinct should always be in the ascendancy, Bond-san. Prostitution is now illegal in Japan. What we are about to visit is a national monument." "Oh, good show." There was a great deal of bowing and hissing at the whorehouse, a spacious establishment in the now-defunct Red Lamp Street of the ancient capital, and they were presented with handsomely bound descriptive booklets by the earnest curator. They wandered over polished floors from chamber to chamber and gravely inspected the sword cuts in the wooden supports that had been inflicted, according to Tiger, by samurai infuriated by lust and impatience. Bond inquired how many actual bedrooms there had been. It seemed to him that the whole place was taken up by a vast kitchen and many dining rooms. "Four rooms," answered the curator. "That's no way to run a whorehouse," commented Bond. "You need quick throughput, like a casino."
"Bondo-san," complained Tiger, "please try and put out of your mind comparisons between your way of life and ours. In former times, this was a place of rest and recreation. Food was served, and there was music and storytelling. People would write tankas. And take that inscription on the wall. It says, 'Everything is new tomorrow.' Some man with a profound mind will have written that."
And then he threw his pen away and reached for his sword and shouted, "When is room number 4 going to be empty? National monument, indeed. It's like in the new African states where they pretend the cannibal stew pot in the chief's hut was for cooking yams for the hungry children. Everyone tries to forget his rowdy past instead of being proud of it, like we are of Bloody Morgan or Nell Gwynn, for instance. The great murderer and the great whore are part of our history. You shouldn't try and pretend that your oldest whorehouse is a sort of Stratford-on-Avon." Tiger uttered an explosive laugh.
"Bond-san, your comments on our Japanese way of life become more and more outrageous. Come, it is time to cleanse your mind in the salubrious breezes of the inland sea."
The Murasaki Maru was a very modern 3,000-ton ship with all the luxuries of an ocean liner. Crowds waved her goodbye as if the ship was setting off across the Atlantic instead of doing a day trip down the equivalent of a long lake. There was much throwing of paper streamers by groups bearing placards to show whom they represented. Business outings, schools, clubs, part of the vast travelling population of Japan, forever on the move, making an outing, visiting relatives or shrines, or just seeing the sights of the country. The ship throbbed grandly through the endless horned islands. Tiger said that there were fine whirlpools, like great lavatory pans, especially designed for suicides, between some of these. Meanwhile, Tiger and Bond sat in the first-class dining room and consumed hamlets, ham omelets, and sake. Tiger was in a lecturing mood. He was determined to correct Bond's boorish ignorance of Japanese culture.
"Bond-san, I wonder if I'll ever get you to appreciate the nuances of the Japanese tanka, all of the haiku, which are the classical forms of Japanese verse. Have you ever heard of basho, for instance?"
"No," said Bond with polite interest. "Who's he?"
"Just so," said Tiger bitterly. "And yet, you'll think me grossly uneducated if I had never heard of Shakespeare, Homer, Dante, Cervantes, Goethe. And yet basho, who lived in the 17th century, is the equal of any of them."
"And what did he write?"
"He was an itinerant poet. He was particularly at home with the haiku, the verse of 17 syllables."
Tiger assumed a contemplative expression. He intoned,
"In the bitter radish that bites into me, I feel the autumn wind. Does that not say anything to you? Or this? A butterfly is perfuming its wings in the scent of the orchid. You do not grasp the beauty of that image.
Rather elusive compared to Shakespeare.
In a fisherman's hut, mingled with dried shrimps, crickets are chirping.
Tiger looked at him hopefully. I can't get the hang of that one, said Bond apologetically.
You do not catch the still life quality of these verses, a flash of insight into humanity, into nature. Now, do me a favor, Bondo-san. Write a haiku for me yourself. I'm sure you could get the hang of it.
After all, you must have had some education. Bond laughed. Mostly in Latin and Greek, all about Caesar and Balbus and so on. Absolutely no help in ordering a cup of coffee in Rome or Athens after I'd left school. And things like trigonometry, which I've totally forgotten. But give me a pen and a piece of paper and I'll have a bash, if you'll forgive the bad joke. Tiger handed them over and Bond put his head in his hands. Finally, after much crossing out and rewriting, he said, Tiger, how's this? It makes just as much sense as old Bashur, but it's much more pithy. He read out, You only live twice. Once when you are born, and once when you look death in the face. Tiger clapped his hands softly. He said with real delight,
But that is excellent, Bondo-san. Most sincere.
He took the pen and paper and jotted some ideograms up the page. He shook his head. No, it won't do in Japanese. You have the wrong number of syllables, but it is a most honorable attempt. He looked keenly at Bond.
You are perhaps thinking of your mission.
Perhaps, said Bond with indifference.
Is it weighing on your mind?
The practical difficulties are bound to do so. I have swallowed the moral principles involved. Things being as they are, I have to accept that the end justifies the means.
Then you are not concerned with your own safety?
Not particularly. I've had worse jobs to do.
I must congratulate you on your stoicism. You do not appear to value your life as highly as most Westerners.
Tiger looked at him kindly.
Is there, perhaps, a reason for that?
Bond was offhand. Not that I can think of. But for God's sake, chuck it, Tiger. None of your Japanese brainwashing. More sake. And answer my question of yesterday. Why weren't those men disabled by those terrific slashes to the groin? That might be of some practical value to me instead of all this waffle about poetry.
Tiger ordered the sake. He laughed.
Unfortunately, you are too old to benefit. I would need to have caught you at the age of about 14. You see, it is this way. You know the small wrestlers? It is they who invented the trick many centuries ago. It is vital for them to be immune from danger to those parts of the body. Now, you know that in men, the testicles, which until puberty have been held inside the body, are released by a particular muscle and descend between the legs?
Yes.
Well, the small wrestler will have been selected for his profession by the time of puberty. Perhaps because of his weight and strength, or perhaps because he comes of a small family. Well, by assiduously massaging those parts, he is able, after much practice, to cause the testicles to re-enter the body up the inguinal canal down which they originally descended.
My God, you Japanese, said Bond with admiration. You really are up to all the tricks.
You mean he gets them right out of the way behind the bones of the pelvis or whatnot?
Your knowledge of anatomy is as vague as your appreciation for poetry, but that is more or less so, yes.
Then, before a fight, he will bind up that part of the body most thoroughly to contain these vulnerable organs in our hiding place. Afterwards, in the bath, he will release them to hang normally. I have seen them do it. It is a great pity that it is now too late for you to practice this art. It might have given you more confidence in your mission. It is my experience that agents fear most for that part of the body when there is fighting to be done or when they risk capture. These organs, as you know, are most susceptible to torture for the extraction of information.
Don't I know it, said Bond from the heart. Some of our chaps wear a box when they think they're in for a roughhouse. I don't care for them, too uncomfortable.
What is a box?
It is what our cricketers wear to protect those parts when they go out to bat. It is a light padded shield of aluminium. I regret that we have nothing of that nature. We do not play cricket in Japan, only baseball. Lucky for you, you weren't occupied by the British, commented Bond. Cricket is a much more difficult and skillful game. The Americans say otherwise. Naturally, they want to sell you baseball equipment. They arrived at Beppu in the southern island of Kyushu as the sun was setting. Tiger said that this was just the time to see the famous geysers and fumaroles of the little spa. In any case, there would be no time in the morning, as they would have to start early for Fukuoka, their final destination. Bond shivered slightly at the name. The moment was rapidly approaching when the sake and sightseeing would have to stop. Above the town of Beppu, they visited in turn the 10 spectacular hells, as they are officially designated. The stink of sulphur was disgusting, and each bubbling, burping nest of volcanic fumaroles was more horrific than the last. The steaming mud and belching geysers were of different colours, red, blue, and orange, and everywhere there were warning notices and skulls and crossbones to keep visitors at a safe distance. The 10th, Hell, announced in English and Japanese that there would be an eruption punctually every 20 minutes. They joined a small group of spectators under the arc lights that pinpointed a small quiescent crater in a rock area bespattered with mud. Sure enough, in 5 minutes, there came a rumbling from underground, and a jet of streaming grey mud shot 20 feet up into the air and splashed down inside the enclosure. As Bond was turning away, he noticed a large, red, painted wheel, heavily padlocked and surrounded by wire netting in a small separate enclosure. There were warning notices above it, and a particularly menacing skull and crossbones. Bond asked Tiger what it was. It says that this wheel controls the pulse of the geyser. It says that if this wheel were screwed down, it would result in the destruction of the entire establishment. It gives the explosive force of the volcano if the exhaust valve of the geyser were to be closed as the equivalent of 1,000 pounds of TNT. It is, of course, all a bit of nonsense to attract the tourists. But now, back to the town, Bond-san. Since it is our last day together, he added hastily, on this particular voyage I've arranged a special treat. I ordered it by radio from the ship, a hugu feast. Bond cursed silently. The memory of his eggs Benedict the night before was intolerably sweet. What new monstrosity was this? He asked. Hugo is the Japanese blowfish. In the water it looks like a brown owl, but when captured it blows itself up into a ball covered with wounding spines. We sometimes dry the skins and put candles inside and use them as lanterns, but the flesh is particularly delicious. It is the staple food of the small wrestlers, because it is supposed to be very strength-giving. The fish is also very popular with suicides and murderers because its liver and sex glands contain a poison which brings death instantaneously. That's just what I'd have chosen for dinner. I'm very thoughtful of you, Tiger. I have no fear, Bondo-san. Because of the dangerous properties of the fish, every hugo restaurant has to be manned by experts and be registered with the state. They left their bags at a Japanese inn where Tiger had reserved rooms, enjoyed the offuro, honourable bath, together in the blue-tiled miniature swimming pool whose water was very hot and smelled of sulphur, and then, totally relaxed, went off down the street leading to the sea. Bond had become enamoured of the civilised, vaguely Roman bathing habits of the Japanese. Was it because of these, because they washed outside the bath instead of wallowing in their own effluvia, that they all smelled so clean? Tiger said bluntly that, at the very best, Westerners smelled of sweet pork. The restaurant had a giant blowfish hanging as a sign above the door, and inside, to Bond's relief, there were Western-style chairs and tables at which a smattering of people were eating with the intense concentration of the Japanese. They were expected, and the table had been prepared. Bond said, "Now then, Tiger, I'm not going to commit honourable suicide without at least 5 bottles of sake inside me." The flasks were brought, all 5 of them, to the accompaniment of much tittering by the waitresses. Bond downed the lot, tumbler by tumbler, and expressed himself satisfied. "Now you can bring on this blasted blowfish," he said belligerently, "and if it kills me, it will be doing a good turn to our friend the doctor and his castle." A very beautiful white porcelain dish, as big as a bicycle wheel, was brought forward with much ceremony. On it were arranged, in the pattern of a huge flower, petal upon petal of a very thinly sliced and rather transparent white fish. Bond followed Tiger's example and set to with his chopsticks. He was proud of the fact that he had reached black belt standard for these instruments, the ability to eat an underdone fried egg with them. The fish tasted of nothing, not even of fish, but it was very pleasant on the palate, and Bond was effusive in his compliments, because Tiger, smacking his lips over each morsel, obviously expected it of him. There followed various side dishes containing other parts of the fish, and more sake, but this time containing raw fugu fins. Bond sat back and lit a cigarette. He said, "Well, Tiger, this is nearly the end of my education. Tomorrow you say I'm to leave the nest. How many marks out of 100? Tiger looked at him quizzically. "You have done well, Bondo-san. Apart from your inclination to make Western jokes about Eastern customs. Fortunately, I am a man of infinite patience, and I must admit that your company has given me much pleasure and a certain amount of amusement. I will award you 75 marks out of a possible 100. As they rose to go, a man brushed past Bond to get to the exit. He was a stocky man, with a white moustache over his mouth, and he wore an ugly leather hat. The man on the train. Well, well, thought Bond. If he shows up on the last lap to Fukuoka, I'll get him. If not, I'll reluctantly put it down to funny coincidence department. But it looks like naught out of 100 to Tiger for powers of observation. Part 2. It is better to travel hopefully than to arrive. Chapter 12. Appointment in Samara. At 6 in the morning, a car from the prefect of police in Fukuoka came for them. There were two police corporals in the front seat. They went off northwards on the coast road at a good pace. After a while, Bond said, "Tiger, we're being followed. I don't care what you say. The man who stole my wallet was in the Fugu restaurant last night, and he's now a mile behind on a motorcycle, or I'll eat my hat. Be a good chap and tell the driver to dodge up a side road and then go after him and get him. I've got a sharp nose for these things, and I ask you to do what I say." Tiger grunted. He looked back and then issued rapid instructions to the driver. The driver said, "Hi," briskly, and the corporal at his side unbuttoned the holster of his M14 automatic. Tiger flexed his powerful fingers. They came to a track on the left, which went into the scrub. The driver did a good racing change and pulled in out of sight of the road. He cut his engine. They listened. The roar of a motorcycle approached and receded. The driver reversed sharply onto the road and tore off in pursuit. Tiger issued more sharp instructions. He said to Bond, "I have told him to try warning the man with his siren, and if he doesn't stop, to ride him into the ditch." "Well, I'm glad you're giving him a chance," said Bond, beginning to have qualms. "I may be wrong, and he may only be a fuller brush man in a hurry." They were doing 80 along the winding road. They soon came up with the man's dust, and then there was the machine itself. The man was hunched over the handlebars, going like hell. The driver said something. Tiger translated. "He says it's a 500cc Honda. On that, he could easily get away from us. But even Japanese crooks are men of discipline. He will prefer to obey the siren." The siren wailed and then screamed. The white mask gleamed as the man glanced over his shoulder. He braked slowly to a stop. His right hand went inside his jacket. Bond had his hand on the door latch. He said, "Watch out, Tiger, he's got a gun." And as they pulled up alongside, he hurled himself out of the door and crashed into the man, knocking him and his machine to the ground. The corporal beside the driver took a flying leap, and the two bodies rolled into the ditch. Almost immediately, the corporal got to his feet. He had a blood-stained knife in his hand. He threw it aside and tore at the man's coat and shirt. He looked up and shook his head. Tiger shouted something, and the corporal began slapping the man's face as hard as he could from side to side. The masker was knocked off, and Bond recognized the snarling rictus of death. He said, sickened, "Stop him, Tiger. The man's dead." Tiger walked down into the ditch. He picked up the man's knife and bent down and slit the right sleeve of the corpse up to the shoulder. He looked and then called Bond down. He pointed to the black ideogram tattooed on the crook of the man's arm. He said, "You're right, Bondo-san. Here's a black dragon." He stood up, and his face contorted, spat out, "Shimata." The two policemen were standing by, looking politely baffled. Tiger gave them orders. They searched the man's clothing and extracted various commonplace objects, including Bond's wallet, with the 5,000 yen still intact, and a cheap diary. They handed everything to Tiger and then hauled the corpse out of the ditch and stuffed it roughly into the boot of the car. Then they hid the motorcycle in some bushes, and everyone dusted themselves and got back into the car. After a few moments, Tiger said thoughtfully, "It is incredible. These people must have a permanent tail on me in Tokyo." He riffled through the diary. "Yes. All my movements for the past week and all the stopping places on our journey. You are simply described as a gaijin, but he could have telephoned a description. This is an unfortunate business, Bondo-san. I apologize most deeply. You may already be incriminated. I will naturally absolve you from your mission. It is entirely my fault for being careless. I have not been taking these people seriously enough. I must talk to Tokyo as soon as we get to Fukuoka. But at least you have seen an example of the measures Dr. Shatterhand takes for his protection. There is certainly more to this man than meets the eye. At some time in his life, he must have been an experienced intelligence agent, to have discovered my identity, for instance, which is a state secret, to have recognized me as his chief enemy, to have taken the appropriate countermeasures to ensure his privacy. This is either a great madman or a great criminal. You agree, Bondo-san?"
"Looks mighty like it. I'm really getting quite keen to have a sight of the fellow. And don't worry about the mission. That was probably just the jolt I needed to get the wind under my tail."
The headquarters of the local department of the Sosaka, the CID, for the southern island of Kyushu, was just off the main street of Fukuoka. It was a stern-looking building in yellow lavatory brick in a style derived from the German. Tiger confirmed that it had been the headquarters of the Kempei Tai, the Japanese Gestapo, before and during the war. Tiger was received with pomp. The office of the chief of the CID was small and cluttered. Superintendent Ando himself looked to Bond like any other Japanese salaryman, but he had a military bearing, and the eyes behind the rimless spectacles were quick and hard. Bond sat patiently smoking, while much conversation went on. A blow-up aerial mosaic of the Castle of Death and the surrounding country was produced from a filing cabinet and laid out on the desk. Superintendent Ando weighed down the corners with ashtrays and other hardware, and Tiger called him over with a respect Bond noticed that was not lost on the superintendent. It crossed Bond's mind that he had heaped much on Tiger, or alternatively that Tiger had lost much face vis-a-vis Bond by the business of the Black Dragon agent. Tiger said, "Please do examine this photograph, Bondo-san. The superintendent says that a clandestine approach from the landward side is now very difficult. The suicides pay local peasants to lead them through these marshlands," he pointed, "and there are recognized breaches in the walls surrounding the property, which are constantly changed and kept open for the suicides. Every time the superintendent posts a guard at one of them, another is made known to the peasants by the castle guards. He says he is at his wit's end. 20 bodies have been fetched to the mortuary in the past week. The superintendent wishes to hand in his resignation."
"Naturally," said Bond. "And then, perhaps, honorable Fugu poisoning. Let's have a look." At first glance, Bond's heart quailed. He might just as well try and storm Windsor Castle single-handed. The estate covered the whole expanse of a small promontory that jutted out into the sea from a rocky coast, and the 200-foot cliff round the promontory had been riveted with giant stone blocks down to the breaking waves to form an unbroken wall that sloped slightly up to gunports and the irregularly sighted tiled watchtowers. From the top of this wall, there appeared to be a 10-foot drop into the park, heavily treed and shrubbed between winding streams and a broad lake with a small island in its centre. Steam appeared to be rising from the lake, and there were occasional wisps of it among the shrubbery. At the back of the property stood the castle, protected from the low-lying countryside by a comparatively modest wall. It would be over this wall that the suicides gained access. The castle itself was a giant, five-storied affair in the Japanese tradition, with swooping, winged roofs of glazed tile.
dolphin-shaped finials decorated the topmost story, and there was a profusion of other decorative devices, small balconies, isolated turrets and gazebos, so that the whole black-painted edifice, edged here and there with what Tiger said was gold paint, gave the impression of a brilliant attempt to make a stage setting for Dracula. Bond picked up a large magnifying glass and ran over the whole property inch by inch, but there was nothing more to be gleaned, except the presence of an occasional diminutive figure at work in the park, or raking the gravel round the castle.